Holy,
you hear that?
You're fired.
I'm hoping that Mal Hoyle can hear
whatever she attorney.
Call to order the House Committee on Rules for Wednesday, March 6. We're going to go out of order, try and take care of these work sessions first. So let's open a work session on House Bill 2078. And Ron Burson and Paul Cosgrove, please come up.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we first heard House Bill 2078 on February 6th, and it requires compensated lobbyists to register with Oregon Government Ethics Commission within 10 days of agreeing to provide lobbying services, or after first appearing to or work for a person whom lobbying has not registered to represent, clarifies lobbyist registration deadline, eliminates grace period during even-numbered years for compensated lobbyists to register with Oregon Government Ethics Commission, requires entity comprised of more than one lobbyist to report expenditures from each lobbyist, and removes requirements that legislative assembly receive notification of violations of lobbying laws. We have a -2 amendment that requires removes requirement that both public and private positions throughout the state register as a lobbyist if part of their job duties included or might include lobbying legislative or executive officials. We did not adopt that amendment at the first hearing.
And if one of you would just remind us where we left things in the last meeting, that would probably be helpful for the committee.
Representative, my name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Ethics Commission. I believe that you'd heard testimony on the bill the last time, and that Mr. Cosgrove had asked for some time to confer with his members of the Capital Club and come back to the committee, and so that's where we're at.
Okay. Mr. Cosgrove?
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove, appearing as the President of the Capital Club. Mr. Burson, I've had several conversations. The issue has to do solely, in our concern, has to do solely with the issue of the automatic termination that's in every odd year and the renewal timeline for renewal and retroactivity of that renewal in every even year. The bill as currently drafted does not have the same sort of retroactivity that currently is in law, which is 90 days, which we think is too long. But we think, after reviewing this with our members, that probably 30 days is more appropriate. That still has the renewal have to be effective before the February session. But then I raised a question with Mr. Burson, and I think he's still looking at it, is given the amount of paperwork for lobbyists, but more importantly in this case for the commission, with these automatic terminations and then flood of renewals every 2 years, is there a reason to do that anymore? Should we not, in fact, just have registrations terminate when contracts terminate? And I think we're still waiting for some response from Mr. Burson on that issue. So that would be, I think, an interesting question for the committee to know an answer to before we took action on and decided what was the appropriate time period for renewals, is whether we need renewals to be terminated anyway.
Okay. So we don't have language?
Not yet, although I think we can.
You mean it? I'm sorry, Chair, to terminate the idea of registrations?
Are we waiting for you all to get together and bring us language?
Mr. Chair, that was an issue I thought was still left in Mr. Burson to get back about whether we should do the terminations at all. The second issue, though, is an unrelated issue that we've talked about where there might be a expenditure reporting issue that this might be an appropriate vehicle to fix.
Right.
And we're waiting for the Commission's response on that. It's an unrelated issue. It's not
right.
Currently covered.
This would be the vehicle for that?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Any questions from, yes, Representative Berger?
So what you're proposing, Paul, is that instead of registering every time, you remain registered until you unregister. What you're saying by changing clients, or you remain registered, but if a client changed, you would then submit paperwork that says now I'm, how does that work on the ground?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, what we raised is the question of whether that makes sense. And the process now works that if I'm registered and I have a contract for just the session, then at the end of the session I file a termination. And the reason you do that is so that your client doesn't have to continue to do quarterly reports for that show zeros, because they will have to do quarterly reports, even if it's only zero, until that registration is terminated. The commission right now automatically terminates all of those every 2 years. So if you have an ongoing relationship with a client, you then automatically go through all the paperwork again. It's filed with them, and they start over. The question we raised is, does the benefit of having everybody clear out the deck, clear out the books every 2 years, outweigh the benefit of avoiding all that paperwork processing every 2 years? Because many of us are representing the same clients for years and years, and it's just literally a ongoing every 2 year flood of paperwork that comes into the commission. Ironically, it comes into the commission all at the same time. I mean, if you terminate because your contract terminates, it maybe whenever that happens, but this automatic termination is always December 31st every odd year. Am I saying that right, Mr. Burson?
Follow up, yeah, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
So, Ron, is there, I mean, I think, I don't know if that works, or I guess what we're all looking for is a way to make this all work better. And if you could get there, I'd be happy. But I don't know if this is the right idea, because I don't know what your process is either.
Chair Garrett, Representative Berger.
And I guess here's the real question. Why are we having this conversation here? Why isn't that conversation happening somewhere else?
Chair Garrett, Representative Berger, this question was posed to me through an email, and maybe we didn't communicate well enough, but I had talked with Mr. Cosgrove about that. I did some research, and before 93, that's the way it was. You were basically registered until you unregistered or terminated your client. The problem was is that that didn't happen. And so the agency spent an exorbitant amount of time trying to clean up those records, finding out who is terminated and who is not. And so in 93, there was a policy change to make it happen every 2 years, cycling with the legislative sessions. And so that's what we've been living with since then. So it does kind of give that cleanup phase, I think, that Mr. Cosgrove talked about. And, you know, I think that's pretty standard with most, you know, licenses and registrations around the state, that there's some time that they do expire and they ask for, you know, re-registration. And so at this time, it's at 2 years. Whether that's the right amount of time or not, that's a policy.
Mr. Chair, I suspect that the reason that it wasn't working before was there was no remedy if they didn't not terminate or whatever. And so maybe you guys could think of some way to do this that would have a remedy that would encourage them to make those terminations that they weren't making before and still simplify this process. And I don't know what that is, but I would just encourage you to go talk about how that might work.
Mr. Chair, for a minute. Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, and other members of the committee, our goal is to try to, we've talked before in the first hearing about how this agency doesn't have an adequate data system in order to simplify its procedures.
Now we're getting
trying to figure out ways to reduce paper load. I mean, that's why I asked the question. It occurred to us that maybe this could be helpful in that regard until it gets an adequate funding for a data system. That was the reason for the raising of the issue.
I don't want to cause problems. Mr. Chair, I'm through.
Well, so I'm a little bit confused about where we stand on the 90, 30, 15-day issue. Can you just explain to us? This is coming at me. I think this is the first time I knew about this, so just
Mr. Chair, the current timeline for after the automatic termination is 90 days. We all agree that's too long because that would mean that it would occur after the time of the even year session. The commission, I think, originally thought that the 10 days that it was proposing for initial registrations would be enough. We surveyed our members. We're more comfortable with 30 days. I think the commission has talked about 15 days. I think that's where we are. And I don't know that this is the most earth-shattering decision for either of us. The reason that we had concern that there'd be some time within the period so that you could have retroactive renewals, 15 or 30, is that it's a time of the year that is difficult to move paperwork in a lot of our clients that might be out of state. It's a holiday time. It's the beginning of a year. If everything automatically terminates on December 31st, so you don't have some grace period, it's highly unlikely we can all get that paperwork done on the 31st. So the question of a grace period, I think, has got to be there. The only question is, what is the reasonable amount of time to get that done?
and Mr. Burson. What's the commission's view?
Just to be clear, the 15-day amendment that you have before us was not from the commission. The commission was at 10 days. And the commission was trying to clarify and simplify things by having one due date, not having a due date and a grace period, because in that grace period that's currently in the statute, you only have that if you were already registered for that client before December 31st. So it gets to be a lot of this I before E, except after it's happening. So we were trying to simplify this through the commission by having 10 days, and that's why we were going from the current 3 days to register a new client to make it 10 days for all clients. Whenever you sign them up, and at the beginning of every odd or beginning of every even numbered year, you're required to sign up your clients through the termination of registrations on December 31st.
Further questions, comments? Perhaps we can meet outside of the committee room and help facilitate a compromise that works on this. Thank you for your testimony. Close the work session on House Bill 2078. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2079, the other Ethics Commission bill that we were reviewing. Ms. Seiler?
Members of the committee, House Bill 2079 was originally heard on February 6th as well. It standardizes definitions of member of household and relative for purposes of ethics laws. The question at the time was the definition of in-laws specifically, so we do have a dash one amendment that does specify which in-laws are being referred to, so it removes in-laws and stepchild and adds son-in-law and daughter-in-law specifically to definition.
Mr. Burson?
Yes, Chair Garrett. The commission went back to the office after the open public hearing, and we tried to come back with an amendment that specified and added clarity to exactly which relatives we were looking at that would be affected by the change in the ethics laws. Currently, right now, the ethics laws, there is a definition for relatives under nepotism, and there's a definition for relatives in all the other laws inside of Chapter 244. The original idea was to combine those two and try to come up with one set of definition, one definition for relatives. The policy change here in the ethics laws portion of it is the addition of a daughter and son-in-law. All the other folks in the in-law categories and everybody else that's inside of this amendment were already there. They were worded confusingly. Is that a real word? It was confusing how they were worded, and so we tried to add some clarity to how it's worded and be very specific on exactly which our relatives that we're looking at. The policy change, I do want to point out that by adding daughter and son-in-law, that would also add them to the restrictions of receiving gifts from a source that has a legislative and administrative interest in the decision or vote of the public official. So they would be restricted to $50, like everybody else. But probably more importantly, they would also be included in the requirements to declare a conflict of interest when making decisions on awarding financial benefit to members of the family out there, including daughter and son-in-laws. All the rest of them are already included in there. So we think, as a commission, we think it's important that this was kind of how far we wanted to drill down in the relatives and what we think is important for people to declare when they're awarding these contracts and maybe using their office for financial gain down to a son and daughter-in-law.
Okay, so just to restate, the policy change is to add son-in-law and daughter-in-law within, the effect would be to add them within the gift restriction of $50 and the conflict of interest disclosure requirements.
Correct. At the same time, we are clarifying some of the language that's in the current statute to be more specific on exactly who we mean so people do not have to try to figure out who we're meaning. And then lastly, under the nepotism laws, currently there are aunts, uncles, nieces, and nephews, and those are removed from the definition. So they would not be subject to the nepotism or any of the ethics laws, including the nepotism laws.
Mr. Berger?
No, I
I think you just explained it. I remember the discussion was that it said in-laws, and nobody knew what an right. in-law was, and this specifies a son-in-law or daughter-in-law.
Yes. The other common in-laws are already included because my spouse's parent is already in there.
Right.
They're the only ones that are brought out specifically in this.
I think this is
Now, I'm going to call Scott Winkles forward, and I wanted members to hear this discussion. There is a disagreement that Mr. Winkles wants to raise to our attention, and I think it's just a policy discussion that we need to have. So please go ahead.
For the record, I'm Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I am the League's lobbyist on all things ethics. I had an email that was sent out to some members of the committee explaining our concerns, and I beg to differ with Mr. Burson a little bit. Yes, we're adding the term son-in-law, but we're also adding step-siblings, which was not clear in the previous statute. I want to be clear, the League doesn't object to expanding that definition when it comes to ensuring people are declaring conflicts of interest, nepotism, and the like. However, what the language does is it also exposes a public official to additional liability in the statute. Under the gift limits in 224.025, a public official is liable for a gift received by a relative from a person with a legislative administrative interest. We have, for time immemorial, have had concerns about that word relative in the ethics statute, because what it does is, if not in practice, in statute, it holds them liable for the actions of a public official for the actions of another person whom they have no legal ability to control and no ability to prevent them from accepting a gift from a person with LAI, legislative administrative interest. That is our concern with the new definition that's been proposed by the commission.
Now that concern exists with current law, doesn't it?
It does concern with, Mr. Chairman, it does exist with current law. However, this does expand it to add some people who
right.
that a public official may have no relationship with or a very negative relationship with.
Are there instances that you can tell us about where public officials have been penalized for a gift received by a family member?
Chairman, I'm not aware of any specific instance where a public official has been sanctioned by the commission for the acceptance of a gift by a family member. Nonetheless, it's still in statute. And also, when we do trainings on this for our members, it does influence behaviors, and it does cause considerable anxiety among volunteer city officials when we explain to them the gift limits and how they are applied. We don't tell them this is what's in the statute, but they're never going to enforce it on you. We explain to them what's in the statute, and it does influence that behavior. It does have some impact on their personal relationships.
Okay, committee. So the question is it reasonable to extend this statute to apply to son-in-law and daughter-in-law and step-sibling? And it's time to discuss. Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I have a question on a slightly different topic, but you may want to have this conversation first.
No, go ahead.
I really need to understand the law better than I do now, and I don't think the statute contains bill contains the relevant sections. Does the nepotism rule prevent nepotism, prevent people from hiring somebody who's within this area of relationship? And that, Mr. Chair, if I could, that being the case, why would you limit it? Why would you remove the people who you say you want to remove? It would seem to me that if the concern is that there might be an interest in those relationships, why would you exclude uncles and the other people that you've just decided to exclude? It would seem to me that in connection with the nepotism statute, they'd be just as likely to be that would just as likely be a favoritism issue as those who are more closely related.
Chair Garrett, Representative Barnard, I just want to point out that the nepotism statutes are just not on hiring of those relatives, but it's also around supervising those relatives. And the statute does allow for a jurisdiction to create policy on being able to supervisor relatives. And what we found is that there are small jurisdictions out there that they may be having their aunts or uncles or nephews working inside of there where the senior member is the supervisor. And so they ask us for this, or that they have to create a policy to exclude those folks. But as far as like why we drew a line there, I believe, it, again, that was kind of a policy decision on our part, is that we felt as though, I think like Mr. Winkles had actually talked about, that sometimes as a family gets so extended that you're not quite sure who it is and who isn't there. And going back to this sibling thing, I just want to point out what I talked about, clarity to the current statute. Siblings are in there, and whether or not we would ever determine that a step-sibling was a sibling, we didn't do that at that point, but we didn't want to get to that point trying to figure out what is a sibling. So we tried to be specific in what we thought siblings were. But I hope I answered your question on nepotism. It is around, it's around hiring, supervising, firing, things like that. And so.
Representative Holvey?
Yeah, I've got another question that's maybe just a little bit off, but I'm trying to understand the amendment and straightening out son-in-laws and daughter-in-laws, but the amendment leaves step-parents in and step-siblings, but it took out step-child. So I'm trying to understand that.
Chair Garrett, Representative Holvey, I don't believe that we actually took out step-child. What we did was, and I'll use myself as an example, the children of my spouse, which are not my biological children, are my children of my spouse, and so they're included in the second line there. So that's where the children would be located at in this in this bill. So the underneath B, the parent, the step parent, the child of my spouse, just personally, would be included in there, even though they're not my biological child, but they're the child of my
wife. Does it
say
the child of your spouse?
Yes, down below at the end of it, it says of the spouse. So it's all these, this parent, step-parent, child, sibling, step-sibling, son-in-law, or daughter-in-law of the spouse.
Okay.
So it's my spouse's children, which are not my biological children, would be included in there. So we tried to get rid of some redundancy.
Oh, it was
also
redundant before is what you're saying. Okay,
yes.
I got you.
Well, and then on the issue that you raised, if I could, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair, I think that the cities may be raising a good issue. This kind of a statute, I mean, it makes my head hurt trying to figure out how you'd write such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, the public interest is that we don't treat relatives favorably in an unreasonable way. Under circumstances that give them an advantage over other people, that would be the nepotism issue, and that we don't allow public officials, or we don't make it easy for public officials to be influenced by activities that involve their relatives inappropriately. But how do you get then to this issue that's raised of the public official that may be ensnared by a gift to a relative over whom that public official has no influence, and therefore expose that public official to a technical violation when in terms of what the purpose of this rule is, there is no violation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to it.
I can see both sides of it, which is why I wanted to have this discussion. Representative Berger.
Yes. Mr. Chair, now you know why I know Mr. Berzin so well, because we spent a whole era picking through this language, and it is very, very difficult to get to. particularly, as Mr. Winkles indicates, that most of the issues that come before the commission are local government issues, and everybody knows everybody, and everybody knows who's related to everybody in the small communities around this state. And at some level, you get people who say, if you make this so overreaching, you get people who say, well, why would I be in public service? My whole family is wrapped up in this thing. But I would also submit to the anxiety point that's why we have an ethics commission, so that if there is an accusation of violation, they can go before the commission and explain, yeah, my stepson did this. Yeah, I had no idea. And the ethics commission can determine at some level the truthfulness of that and make a recommendation. So, there's no way out of this wilderness, in my opinion, except to get the best language we can, and I kind of like this language, I'll be honest with you, because this anxiety will always be there in this. You can't, I don't know how we can get away from it, Scott. I do like this language better than the language before. I think it is an improvement, more clarifying and more direct. But I don't think we're going to solve this problem here today.
Any further discussion? Representative Jensen.
Sure.
Thank you.
Following with Representative Berger, I think the reference to especially rural, small communities around the state where there used to be a sign in the Echo Hotel. It was really an Echo Bar, but the sign was an appropriate sign and illustrates it. It says, a small town is where everyone knows whose check is good and whose husband isn't. Everybody, you know, I mean, they're very, very tightly knit communities. And I think we're playing with this, I think we're threatening somewhat the structure of some of these small communities like this, because people get a look at, this type of bill, and they're not, I mean, most of those jobs, paid though they, some of them might be, the pay is pretty inconsequential. And it really involves volunteer help in the small communities, to fill these otherwise quite critical positions. And you'd get you get tied down with this kind of a bill, and everybody says, not me. I don't want to get involved in that. There they sit without the pool of human resources that they need to be able to run their day-to-day business, of those small communities. So I think we need to, I'm glad the bill came forward. I was not pleased with the bill originally. But I think we need to look very carefully at that and think through very thoroughly how we deal with this issue that Representative Berger, started for us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
To my point, one of the loosey-goosey pieces was what's an in-law. I think this language in the dash, what is it, two?
Dash one.
Dash one. Dash one says who an in-law is.
Yeah, it does.
Yep. It's better.
It's much better.
Representative
Denbrough? I'm curious about the addition of the step siblings to begin with. I mean, the steps. Was there a perceived need for that? I mean, what was the genesis of that addition?
Chair Garrett, Representative Denbrough, there were discussions on, basically the discussions kind of all came out of what we see come before the commission. It's very common, and Ian Wedlock is with me today. He is the commission chair, and he can speak to this also. It's very common for the commission to have public officials before them that have not declared conflicts of interest that include relatives. And it's very common for that relative to include a stepchild or a stepbrother and sister and include daughter and son-in-laws. And so the commission is trying to be very clear to folks out there to tell them when they're making these public decisions on public financial benefits out there that if you have a person that wants to apply for that benefit, that you have a conflict and you should declare it. We had a very recent example in a very small community in the eastern side of the state, and I think where the commission landed on that, and that involved down to stepdaughter and son that received a contract for a public building, a restroom that was being built in the town square that was a construction contract that was voted on by a public official that was related to these folks. But I think where the commission ended up landing on that was that they required them to have a letter of education and also required us as staff to actually travel to that community and have a talk with their public officials on what their responsibility is. And sometimes when you come in there with the current statute that we have, we start talking about spouses of siblings and siblings, you get confused unless you kind of sit down and talk about this. So we were trying to get some very plain language, and the commission does see that those type of relatives come before it on these conflict of interest and use of office. And that's kind of where it came from, the need for this bill.
Thank you. Is there further, Representative Holby?
Just one issue to Mr. Winkle's, I guess, concern. So, say my stepson accepts a plane ticket to Hawaii from a lobbyist who has interest in the legislature, and I know about it and don't say anything about it. How would you treat me as opposed to would I be in violation in that case, or if I actually, once I found out about it, notified the Ethics Commission, said I had no idea it did that? I mean, would you treat that those scenarios differently?
I'm going to have
Mr. Chair, Ian Whitlock.
Could you speak into the microphone, please? Thanks.
Ian Whitlock, Chair of the Ethics Commission. Representative Holby, I obviously can't speak for the commission as a whole or commit them, but from my experience serving on the commission now for several years, I can tell you with some confidence that, yes, those cases are treated differently. People who come forward with acknowledgement of violations of one form or another, whether they be the gift limits or the lobbying rules, are treated differently than those whose cases come to us through other means, complaints, for example. Those issues are taken into consideration.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the discussion. I think I find myself leaning toward the view that, as Representative Berger said, this is an inherently imperfect area, but I believe this amendment and the bill is in keeping with the spirit of what we're trying to do, which is have a statute that covers the appropriate people. And when we have situations arise where we need leniency, I think we have to, at some level, trust the commission is going to exercise judgment. So would you like to make a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2079.
Representative Berger moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2079. Is there further discussion on the motion? Is there objection? Okay, seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2079 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves House Bill 2079 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Okay. Seeing none, the motion is adopted. And Representative Berger, would you be so kind as to carry it?
Let no good deed go unpunished.
I would be happy to. Mr. Chair.
Thank you all for helping us sort through this.
He knows a bunch more about Anne.
Yes.
That looks blindsided. This is fun.
Close the work session on House Bill 2079 and open a work open a public hearing on House Bill 2215. Leonie Reeves, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2215 provides that person holding a point of office in state government serves at pleasure of appointed power that made the appointment to the office. There is a no revenue and no fiscal impact on the measure.
Thank you. Chair Garrett, Vice Chairs Hicks and Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Leonie Reeves, and I'm General Counsel to Governor Kitzhaber. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2215. I'd like to start out by talking a little bit about what House Bill 2215 does not do. This is not a bill that's specific to the governor's appointive powers. This bill applies to any appointive power, which could include the governor, legislative leadership, the chief justice, or a board or commission that makes an appointment. This is not a bill that expands or intends to expand any existing authority beyond what is already in statute currently. And this is not a bill that intends to change any removal standard from a for-cause standard to a no-cause standard. What House Bill 2215 does do is clarifies existing law to provide that unless a statute specifically states a for-cause standard for removal, that an appointed person serves at the pleasure of the appointing authority that appointed them to their position. To discuss the background, I'd like to just briefly talk about the three different ways that people are typically appointed. The first way is that an appointee is appointed to a term of office, like 4 years, and the language says that the person serves at the pleasure of the appointing authority, or it has specific language that says the person can be removed at any time. The second way appointments may be described in statutes is that an appointee serves for a set term, like 4 years, and then it describes some sort of for-cause removal standard. An example of this type of statute can be found in the statutes around the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, and this is just an example, but that statute says that a commissioner may only be removed for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. It specifically says that the person can only be removed for cause. The third type of statute that sets up appointments is the type that says the appointment is for a certain set term, like 4 years, but there's no language about whether or not the person can be removed only for cause, and there's no language that says they serve at the pleasure of the appointing authority. What House Bill 2215 attempts to do is clarify this third type of situation, that if there is a term of office, like a 4-year set term, and no language about removal and no for-cause standard, that the person holding the appointive office serves at the pleasure of the appointing authority and can be removed at any time. The statute that House Bill 2215 amends, Oregon Revised Statute 236.140, already provides the default statute for this type of situation by providing that it says a person holding an appointive office, quote, at all times be subject to removal by the appointed power, end quote. The statute could, however, be found to be ambiguous about what the removal standard is. It says that the person can be removed at any time, but it doesn't say what the removal standard is. So what House Bill 2215 does is clarifies our understanding that unless a for-cause standard is explicitly stated in an appointing statute, that the default is that the person serves at the pleasure of the appointing authority, and as ORS 236-140 already says, is at all times subject to removal by the person or the entity that appointed them. Again, we are not attempting to change any standards of removal. If there is a for-cause standard for removal currently, that would remain in effect. What we're trying to do is just clarify the situations when there is no for-cause standard for removal, that the person serves at the pleasure of the appointing authority that appointed them to that position, which could be removal by the governor or the legislative leadership or the Chief Justice or whatever entity may have appointed them to that particular seat. Unless there's a for-cause standard specifically put in the statute. We're trying to clarify the existing law that the person serves at the pleasure of the appointing authority. Unless there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer questions.
I think I have a bunch of questions. Who was first? Representative Vice Chair Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is the at the pleasure of language used elsewhere in the scheme of statutes that govern this topic?
Chair Garrett, Vice Chair Hicks, there are many, many statutes that set up appointments that specifically use serves at the pleasure language.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a definition of appointive office in the statutes?
Chair Garrett, Representative Barnhart, I do not believe so, but I could certainly look into that and get back to this committee.
Is a circuit court position appointive when a governor fills a vacancy by appointment?
The way the statute reads, Chair Garrett, Representative Barnhart, the way the statute reads is a person holding an appointive office in any of the offices, departments, or institutions of this state shall hold the same for an indefinite term, not exceeding 4 years, and shall at all times serve, at all times be subject to removal by the appointive power that made the appointment. To try to answer your question specifically, this statute serves as a default statute. So if there is a different scheme or if there is a different removal scheme or set term of office that is more specific somewhere else, this statute doesn't apply.
Well, thank you. Then I think this language, notwithstanding any other provision of law, probably is inappropriate. Probably you want instead a language that says something like, if there's no other statute that applies or if the other statute's ambiguous, then, because this language appears to say this is the rule no matter what.
I was going to ask the same question. The way this is worded, it's almost like this is going to trump everything else by saying, notwithstanding any other statute that exists, we are now saying anybody who's appointed serves at the pleasure of the governor. I don't think that's what the intent was, but I think Representative Barnhart may be correct about how this could be interpreted.
Chair Garrett, Representative Barnhart, that was certainly not our intent, and right. We would be amenable to any amendment that would clarify that.
Okay. Were there further, Representative Berger?
Yes, I want to make sure that this statute applies to state government appointees only, any level of state government? That's what it says in the provides that hold in state government. That's what it says in the summary, but I'm not sure what this, I mean, does this include all local government appointees? Is this?
Chair Garrett, Representative Berger, I believe if you look at the context of the statute, it would be more clear that this only applies to state government, but I could certainly get some clarifying language.
I guess I need that on the record.
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
Representative Dembrough? No. Further questions? Okay, I think we've identified a couple maybe drafting issues and a couple of questions that were asked. So if we can just, Representative Barnhart.
If I could just follow up on, mm-hmm. on Representative Berger's point. An institution of the state, I mean, I'm not sure I know what those words mean specifically, but of course all counties and cities are institutions of the state because they have their authority as a result of either the state constitution or charters or statutes. So that makes them state institutions in at least one sense of that term. So unless there's a definition that makes it clear that they're excluded, unless you wanted to include them, of course, then maybe that's an issue as well.
Chair Garrett, Representative Barnhart, I will look into that issue and get back to the committee.
Okay, I think there's no more testimony on this bill. So, Liani, thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2215, and we'll take this up again in the future when we have gotten a little bit more clarity. Open a public hearing on our final bill, House Bill 2560. Ms. Seiler?
Members, House Bill 2560 prohibits appointment of person to rulemaking advisory committee if person serves on public board, commission, committee, or work group and rule would affect activities of said board, commission, or committee. There is a dash 2 amendment which prohibits an agency required by law to appoint rulemaking advisory committee from appointing officer, employee, or an agent of the agency to serve on the advisory committee. We do not have the paperwork on the dash 2 amendment.
All right. Marilyn Lawrence and Matt Marquis, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing Bristol-Myers Squibb today, in support of House Bill 2560, dealing with rural advisory committees. Our intent of the legislation was to say that if a state agency, a board, or a commission, or thereabouts, would be appointing a rural advisory committee, which in most cases aren't required to be appointed, that if they were going to appoint one, they wouldn't be appointing themselves, so to speak, so that the advisory committee wouldn't then be giving advice to themselves. The dash 2 amendments were drafted at our request that limit the scope of the legislation to simply say that that you couldn't appoint yourself to a rural advisory committee if under statute you were required to appoint a rural advisory committee. And the logic here is that we simply don't think that if you have to appoint a rural advisory committee, that they should be open to the public, they should be open to stakeholders to be able to give input as to what the rules should say before the state agency adopts those rules. It doesn't mean that a state agency couldn't staff the committee. It doesn't say they couldn't participate in the committee. They just can't be a member of the Rural Advisory Committee. I think the dash 2s narrow the scope to a point where it takes out a lot of the concerns that you may hear about after me. I think there are only a handful of different state agencies or different boards that are required by statute under 183.133 to actually appoint a Rural Advisory Committee. Excuse me, a Rural Advisory Committee. But I'm happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Lawrence?
For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Chair Garrett and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to review for the record some technical concerns that our agency has identified based on our particular statutory construction and the relationship between our agency and its statutorily defined policy committees and board, and then the relationship in statute between those public bodies and the public safety groups that each of those members represent. The statutes governing our agency call for our 24-member board to develop minimum standards for public safety professionals, specifically by rulemaking, working through 5 discipline-specific policy committees. The committees represent each of the public safety disciplines that we regulate, which include police, corrections, parole and probation, fire, 911 dispatch, polygraph examiners, and private security and private investigation professionals. Board and policy committee membership is specifically identified in statute, and their members represent all segments of their professions, from agency heads to line staff. The mission of those members is specifically to serve as a liaison, as a representative between their specific segment of the public safety industry and the larger policy decisions of DPSST and its board. Our policy committees and the subcommittees or work groups that they use for complex rulemaking all serve as rulemaking advisory committees as these bodies develop the minimum standards through our rulemaking processes. The rules that they develop also govern the processes that they use to enforce those standards. The policy committee and board members forward information about proposed rule changes to the specific constituency groups within public safety that they represent. They likewise then represent those concerns at policy committee and board meetings. And this process provides for systematic two-way feedback and ensures maximum input from all of the elements of the public safety community whose membership is derived from the statutes that outline that membership, again, of our 24-person board and the multiple policy committees. House Bill 2560 prohibits committee and board member participation in rule advisory committees if the rules relate to the subsequent board activities. But the rules that our particular board and committee members are charged to oversee then impact all of their future decision-making as they enforce the minimum standards. The enforcement provisions are adopted by rule, so that is then the subsequent work of the committee as they interpret and enforce the minimum standards that they have established. It appears to us as though this bill, as introduced, would not allow our particular board and policy committee members to serve in one of the key roles that our statutes outline for them, to serve as those representatives adopting and enforcing minimum standards by rule. I thank you for the opportunity again, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
But how does the proposed amendment affect your position on the bill, if at all?
Mr. Chair, I have not seen the amendment.
It would limit this bill to agencies that are required by law to appoint a rule advisory committee. Is DPSST required by law to appoint?
Mr. Chair, no, we are not. Okay. So that would, yes, absolutely.
So that would solve
that
your
would
problem.
Remove, that
may
would
not
remove
solve
our
problem.
Agency.
Okay.
If that's the effect of that amendment. Thank
All right.
you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you both. Brian Krieg and Peggy Lynch.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Krieg, here today representing the sheet metal and air conditioning contractors, the plumbing mechanical contractors, and the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers. It is possible that the Dash 2 will eliminate our concerns on that. The building and construction trades have numerous boards housed under the Building Codes Division, of which differing boards have differing rules and enforcement rules. And in the early version of this, this would have a significant impact on that, in that we quite often have differing levels of subcommittees that are dealing with issues from code adoption to penalty enforcement to rule making that occurs after we have legislative changes that come in. I've served on many of those myself, as many of other members who are on the actual boards do. So we're going to want to look at that and have an opportunity to run that by a few of the folks who are much smarter than I am. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. Having just seen the Dash 2s, I think in my private conversations with Matt, probably our concerns have been alleviated. I haven't read 183.133. I follow natural resource agencies, and I follow their rulemaking very closely, and the League follows the wants to make sure that citizens have an opportunity to participate in rulemaking, and so whenever I see a bill related to rulemaking, we read them because we want to make sure that that continues. Board members of these natural resource agencies, board or commission members, very often chair rulemaking advisory committees, but most work is done in consensus, and there's never a majority of the board or commission that is on the rulemaking committee that then advises or suggests the final rule that the majority of the board eventually has to deal with. So I think probably we're fine with this now. I just wanted to raise the flag and share that natural resource agencies do a really good job of outreach and providing membership for everybody to have a voice when they're making their rules. So I just wanted to give that an opportunity to be heard.
All right, thank you. We're not going to move the bill today. I want to make sure people have a chance to review the amendment. But I do appreciate the amendment being offered. Is there further? Representative Berger.
Yes, if I could comment. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For going to those rulemaking hearings, for being a listening ear. I think that you understand why this bill resonates with the public, because there are an endless list of these, and they impact the lives of Oregonians, and there's a real need to have it be clear that it is being done for the good of the public, not for the good of the agency. And I think that's what is resonating here. So I'm really happy to hear you go, and I hope that there is participation in all rulemaking, and I think that's what this speaks to. The details are tough to get, but the concept is pretty darn clear. And so thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your willingness to come forward, and particularly thank you for going to those natural resources. It's kind of like going to the dentist, but it's really essential. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I just want to say it really is important what natural resource agencies do. They affect people's lives very severely, so we want to make sure that they do good things for Oregonians. As a part of the Citizens Involved in Advisory Committee for LCDC a number of years ago, we created a citizen guidelines for LCDC to follow to be sure that the rulemaking is inclusive and provides adequate opportunity for citizen input. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Representative Kennemer, question?
Well, I just... The amendments available, they're not on our...
No, they're not on all
on our system. I can't pull them up.
Then no, they aren't. We have a copy here.
Well, I wondered about that.
Don't
rule in the blind.
They will become available momentarily, and we will take this up again in the near future in a work session once we've confirmed that the amended language resolves the issues. Further comments? All right, thank you, everyone. Yes, sorry, I keep cutting people off. Representative Holby.
Sorry, I just have, probably a question that may never come up or have come up in the past. I'm just wondering what would happen with some obscure agency or that needed to appoint an advisory committee and didn't have the stakeholders or volunteers available to appoint anyone to that. What would happen in that scenario?
I don't know.
Correct answer.
Closing the public hearing on House Bill 2560. Thank you, everyone. Our
Mr. Chair, for the record, it appears I owe you breakfast.
Oh. Okay.
You've got that before 4 o'clock.